The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Of 831,383 people. Before 1919, women were not allowed to vote at all. When women were given the right to vote, it was under quote-unquote safe and rigid qualifications. For example, women had to be 25 years old to vote, compared to men having to be 21 years old. While men had to pay taxes or rates on real property amounting to no less than 10 shillings in order to vote, women had to pay upwards of £2. On the grounds of their sex alone, women were banned from altogether from running for office, both local and national. And where men who registered to vote before 1893 didn't need to have to be literate, functionally literate, women had to be functionally literate to vote. So this was the social, political, and economic climate under which some of these revolutionaries like Hubert Harrison from St. Croix in the Virgin Islands experienced and came out of. So Harrison, recognized for his quote-unquote outstanding intelligent gifts, he joined the Socialist Party in 1901. And through he was highly influential within the emerging black radical milieu. Harrison was thoroughly underrepresented in history. He was recognized by A. Philip Randolph as the father of Harlem radicalism. Harrison represented a bifurcated radical current of black socialism and black nationalism, both powerful but unequal. Harrison was recognized as an excellent writer and quickly drew negative attention for writing a letter to the New York Sun criticizing Booker T. Washington's politics, which capitulated to wealthy whites, as opposed to demanding that black people have full access to education, voting rights, and civic opportunities. Harrison lost his job at the post office through the vindictive actions of Booker T. Washington and his cronies, namely Charles Anderson, who referred to Harrison as a troublemaker, and who himself was a powerful politician and good friend of the Postmaster General. Harrison, upon receiving a full-time position in the Socialist Party, used his position to further criticize Anderson and Washington, right, showing how much of a troublemaker he really was. In 1914, Harrison left the SP after several years, disgusted with the party's lack of commitment to black workers and racism within the party's leadership. Harrison did, however, disobey orders from party SP leadership to not participate in debate. The question at hand was, is industrial action more important than political action? Harrison answered in the affirmative, which was against the party line, and answering a letter from the executive committee ordering his cease of all debate, Harrison wrote, "Dear Ms. Sloan," who was the secretary of the executive committee of the SP, "please tell the executive committee to go chase itself." Hubert Harrison. "P.S. By the way, if my color has anything to do with it this time, I should thank you to let me know." Unquote. In the same year, Harrison joined the IWW, the International Workers of the World, with Big Bill Haywood. More pleased with their principled and anti-racist commitment to the working class, he was the first to give Marcus Garvey a public platform upon his arrival in NYC in 1916. Garvey was published in Harrison's first issue of The Voice in 1917. It was Harrison's voice that crystallized the radicalism of black folks in New York and the surrounding area at this period. In the early years of his political career, he aligned with socialist politics in the IWW. In his later years, however, Harrison aligned with black nationalist politics. His complicated experience in Marxist organization and conflicts with American socialist leaders and their lack of anti-racist practice in a time when black folks were facing race riots, job scarcity, and large-scale political disenfranchisement undoubtedly contributed to his shift in political orientation. However, the nature of his of the his very experience at, in of Black Americans could not shake the fundamentally Marxist political conclusions of Harrison. Harrison consistently proclaimed that Black people were the most proletarianized layer of the American population, affirming that the capitalist system could never serve the interests of the Black people. Harrison, both in his writings and the Justice Department in their reports on Harrison, indicated he was as ecstatic about the Bolshevik Revolution as and its socialist promise as any radical in America. This optimism about Bolshevik Revolution was not isolated to Harrison, but a sentiment shared by many Black revolutionaries and intellectuals of the time. Harrison kept the faith with socialism, but unfortunately, there was no reciprocity when it came to American socialists in this period. So like Black socialists before him and socialists after him, the SP in America and other formations of the left did not keep the faith with the radical egalitarianism of Marx. The party banned white members from speaking to Black audiences on socialism, regardless if they were in integrated meetings or not, which I think more so reflected the climate, the racial climate of the U.S. during that time in the turn of the century, right? This included Eugene Debs, because he insisted on talking about the race question, all in order to get the Southern vote, Harrison wrote. Quote, they wanted the votes of the South then and were willing to betray by silence the principle of internal racial solidarity which they espoused on paper, essentially accusing the SP of opportunistically putting race first and class after when they needed the help of the Black masses. Black nationalists were not without criticism from Harrison, but also not without his a sympathetic ear. He argued that the nationalistic strategy of race came from a position of defense. Quote, he said, any man today who aspires to lead the Negro race must set squarely before his face the idea of race first, just as the white men of these and other lands are white men before they are Christians, Anglo-Saxons, or Republicans. So the Negroes of this and other lands are intent upon being Negroes before they are Christians, Englishmen, or Republicans. Sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Charity begins at home, and our first duty is to ourselves. It is not what we wish, but what we must that we are concerned with. The world, as it ought to be, is still for us, as for others, and the world that does not, and that is the world that does not exist. The world as it is the real world, and it is to that real world that we address ourselves, striving to be men and finding no effective aid in the government or in its politics. The Negro of the Western world must follow the path of the Swadeshi movement of India and the Sinn Féin movement of Ireland. The meaning of both of these terms is ourselves first. Harrison's nationalism was a last resort of a Black socialist in a racist land, proving in a sense that in order for working class Americans, much less the world, to win, they had to overcome racism and racist ideas in their organizations to be effective and successful in bringing socialism to American shores. Harrison's Black nationalism was in a sense a compromise in a period when the American socialist left was not mature enough to both articulate a principled anti-racist perspective and to put that theory into practice. So at the time of Harrison's activity in the growing Black radicalization in Harlem, a small group of radicalizing Black thinkers from the West Indies were emerging from the Black left. Though African American thinkers overwhelmingly embraced a capitalist ethos as a pathway to freedom and independence, this impulse was also accompanied by a sense of sharing inherent to an African roots and the notion of the land as reciprocity for collective values. In the early 20th century, the SP adopted a pure class outlook, and even Eugene Debs could not understand the distinctive elements of the Black experience and the special demands of African Americans. Otto Hughswood of Suriname, Claude McKay of Jamaica, Cyril Briggs of St. Kitts, all played major roles in shifting the political orientation of the American socialist left to take on the Black question. Hugheswood was an active member in the 24th Assembly District Club of the SP, where he met Arthur Hendricks, of British Guiana. Hugheswood joined the Socialist Left Wing, which was a faction within the SP, which was involved in a very bitter faction fight with Hendricks, and was later expelled from the SP. Hugheswood then, among a group of many other socialists and communists, formed the Communist Party. And if Hugheswood and McKay were any indication of black socialists' regard to the Bolshevik Revolution as a powerful force built from below that could and would take on the black question in a meaningful way, he took the opportunity of being invited to address the Fourth Communist International seriously. In taking the Comintern to task, Hugheswood, like many West Indians, came to the conclusion that in order to seriously integrate the black question, Marxists had to include in their analysis the psychological aspects of the question. Recognizing that though the black question was and still is a chiefly economic problem, what black people faced was worsened and deepened by frictions between white-black races. Hugheswood argued what was a commonly accepted perception among communists already, that the question of race is based on prejudice arising from class prejudice of specific groups in society. Hugheswood cited the U.S. as an example. Competition between black and white workers in a main source of racial hatred, but did not dismiss the fact that black folks still bear the mark of bondage stemming from slavery. And for this reason, the antagonism between white and black workers took a special form. Further, that particularly in the U.S. and the West Indies, black labor was cheap labor. And the capitalist class used black labor to put down white workers, and conversely, the white guard forces were recruited from the ranks of black folks to be used anywhere there was revolutionary uprising. Hugheswood furthered his analysis of the plight of black folks by raising awareness of the rise of the black bourgeoisie out of the struggling black masses, infected like a virus with capitalist bourgeois ideas. Hugheswood was not complacent in his opposition to capitalism and racism. He was not satisfied with institutions who, though were built by black working class folks and or black radicals, refused to go the distance in critiquing capitalism with the intent of overturning it to free the black masses. He characterized the NAACP composed of most proletarian forces, but led by bourgeois intellectuals, who, quote, whose activities was based on petitioning the capitalist class to improve the conditions of blacks, which in practical terms is simply a form of begging, unquote. He referred to Garvey's organization, which is telling of its of itself as an organization with a prominent singular leader, which, among other reasons, was the source of organizational vulnerability, as an ultra-nationalist but has radical membership, which is anti-imperialist and able to awaken the black masses from the states to the interior of Africa. The third organization, which Hugheswood was a part of, was the African Blood Brotherhood, a radical black organization whose program was based on the destruction of capitalism and the only one to wage the struggle during the racial battles in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the race riots that were, folks were in Curie's talk the last session. The Tulsa, Oklahoma race riots were riots that were directed towards the black middle class and like black capital in communities, in black communities. So Hugheswood's level of attention to detail with regard to the makeup of the North and South during the Fourth Comintern gave an idea of his view of the importance of the black question and the importance of the Comintern to respond correctly, both in theory and in practice, warning comrades of the intense racism of and black disenfranchisement that existed in the American South and the potential of race baiting. Hughes would characterizing the relationship between whites and blacks in the South as consisting of continual conflicts and life and death struggles, where one could find both lynchings and racial uprisings. Where, quote, the lynching of a black person is the occasion of enjoyment as it is elsewhere to go to the cinema, unquote. And that comrades had to take up the question of the white population of the South being imbued with the notion of white domination over blacks. It was no doubt that these were dire times in for black people in the US, and black West Indian socialists saw this and insisted that if the communists were to take up the question of colonialism and the black question seriously, they had to see the playing field for what it was. It was a battlefield. Claude McKay, a Jamaican-born poet and writer, characterized as a critical free thinker and fellow ABB member to Hughes-Wood and Briggs, also addressed the Fourth International. He wasn't invited, he just like showed up. And they said, you know, obviously you've got skin in this, we're gonna put you on the floor and you could, you know, tell us how to intervene and how to formulate our theory on colonialism and the black question. So McKay, in typical fashion, was very critical of American communists and the American capitalist governing. He contrasted the Comintern, however, as actually being for the emancipation of the working class as a whole, both in theory and in practice, as opposed to the US and their 15th Amendment. McKay spoke of black people being used by the world bourgeois capitalists against the interests of the working class by sowing division amongst the working class. He gave examples of how indispensable the black working class has been in France, for instance, in carrying out the, quote, policies of imperialist subjugation of Europe. In the US, black people fighting as soldiers of the capitalist class took on an interesting contradictory context as blacks were forced to fight for the capitalists in the Spanish-American War. They still had to weather a struggle of equality and against violent racist mobs. He spoke about the continual use of blacks against the organized working class and how the international intentional diversion of the intent of attention away from the ruling class towards the black masses had fostered a particular horrendous environment for black people in the US. Furthermore, he sort of highlighted how this prejudice had found its way into the ranks of the American socialists and communists. And these prejudices only proved to weaken the left. And in order to build a formidable left opposition, the American communists and socialists have to overcome the attitudes toward blacks, after which they would be better able to reach the black people with any form of radical propaganda and agitation. He spoke of the fear of that capitalists and the ruling class must have had, the idea of black and white workers en masse coming together to organize and discuss their grievances, and the possibility sort of like political upheaval from below, from the working class. Such a high level of caution existed that laws were put into place that not only prevented workers from different races from meeting together legally, but also prevented large groups of blacks from meeting together. McKay lived most of his life in Europe in the 1920s, and upon arriving back in the US in 1934, was attacked by the CP. Despite this incident, he remained a socialist, an advocate for black liberation, and in his final years, he was close to the Catholic workers' movement as religion played a significant role in his upbringing. McKay was considered an inspirer of the Harlem Renaissance generation and of black writers in general. So I want to move on to the actual like the nitty gritty of the ABB and sort of like the contention that they had with Garvey and the UNIA. In 1918, wartime migration had expanded the nation's ghettos. Tens of thousands of black men returned from the war and were unwilling to tolerate submission to racial attack. this coupled with the growth of a black intelligentsia and a black crowd of militant writers, idealists and organizers. Among them was Cyril Briggs of St. Kitts. Unlike his contemporaries, Briggs did not come to the movement as a socialist. He considered himself a quote-unquote race man, and oddly enough, was optimistic of President Woodrow Wilson's so-called support of the right of German people to have a voice in their government. This optimism was quickly undermined by the execution of 15 black soldiers who mutinied against their white officer in Houston, Texas. Hughes would quickly abandon Wilson, but deepened his idea around the right for self-determination, which was intensified by the impact of the Irish Easter Uprising. The rebellion exemplified the revolutionary nationalism that found its way to the rhetoric voiced on the street corners and in the emerging black radical press. So Briggs' paper, The Crusader, initially took a nationalist message, but developed a class orientation as time went on. In 1919, The Crusader concluded the aim of the League of Nations, which was the precursor to the United Nations, was not to prevent war, but, quote, to suppress the revolutions on the part of the oppressed and dissatisfied, unquote. Briggs went on to write that the League of Nations was far from being a vehicle of ending colonialism. It was actually a cover for thieves and tyrants to maintain a grip over their empires. Wow, okay. So... So Briggs, Garvey, some contentious debates, there was a lot of shade thrown around. So Briggs insisted that Garvey would sort of take up working class orientation in the UNIA with the amount of sort of power that he had in the numbers of the UNIA, the overwhelming numbers of the UNIA, and form a leadership among the UNIA leadership and the ABB leadership that would advance that struggle and also make it an international struggle for black liberation. Garvey insisted that racial prejudice was congenital, however, and appeals to whites were useless. Briggs took issue with this and with Garvey's moans of colored radicals having common cause with the Bolsheviki, which was a quote from Garvey. Calling Garvey's analysis superficial, Briggs saw the ABB as a vanguard of sorts, and Garvey's movement to Briggs was the greatest development of modern racial organization. And whatever puffery and self-aggrandizement afflicted Garvey, and whatever deleterious influence of the quote-unquote intellectual nincompoops who surrounded him, Briggs believed that the UNIA and the ABB could guide and could be a radical mass movement and foundation for global racial unity. Garvey didn't think this. He was staunchly against socialists and communists, mainly because of his orientation towards black capital and the accumulation of wealth for black folks. You know, creating a black capitalist class to sort of combat a white capitalist class, which in all actuality plays into capitalism as a whole, right? And strengthens capitalism as a whole. So the argument between Briggs and Garvey quickly devolved, and the ABB and Briggs were unable to win the majority of the rank and file away from Marcus Garvey. Though they did recruit three of members from the leadership, it didn't really help them raise their visibility in the black community. And ultimately, the ABB was absorbed into the Communist Party. So I want to go on, fast forward a little bit to C.L.R. James. And sort of C.L.R. James' critique of the need for the right for self-determination. According to James, to merely accept black folks as a more than usual oppressed section of the American working class, he had They had to lead to both the neglect of the political past of black folks and a lack of historical imagination to the envisioning of the future of the for political development. I would go further to consider the high and lows of intensity in the practice of the early 20th century of American communist organization didn't help to progress the black American masses as well as it could have. The ebb and flow of intentionality of communist organization and organized labor developed from the black working class and poorly contributed, at least partially, to the insularity and pessimism of the black masses towards organized labor and communist ideas and organizations. So James pointed out that the advocacy of the right for self-determination of the Negro means that the Negroes themselves must determine their own future. And the SWP will watch carefully the political development of the masses of the Negroes and will emphasize their right to make this important decision themselves and the obligation of all revolutionaries to support whatever decisions the Negroes may finally come to as a necessity for the Negro state. This was like in the time where, you know, of this like sort of Stalinist ideas of the black belt of the U.S., the black South, being separating from the state and being a black state in and of itself, in like the late 30s, I believe. So I think one important person that I want to wrap up on in mentioning is Claudia Jones. Claudia Jones was born in Belmont, Trinidad, in Port of Spain, which is the capital, and immigrated to New York City with her family following a cocoa crash in Trinidad in the post-war times. She contributed greatly to the Marxist understanding of particular exploitation and oppression of black women faced under capitalism, as well as her condemnation of imperialism, which exposed Jones to most vicious targeting by the U.S. state forces, leading to harsh confinement and eventually deportation. So Carol Boyce Davies explains in Left of Karl Marx, which everybody should pick up if they want to learn about like West Indian revolutionaries and whatnot. It's a really, really good book, very clear and concise. Quote, the deportation of Claudia Jones, in a sense, affected the deporting of the radical female subject from U.S. political consciousness. Jones's position on the super exploitation of black working class women was an unromanticized material analysis, allowing for an equally systematic approach to strategizing for a solution to the exploitation of all people. So where do black women appear in the usurping of surplus value of labor? In her time, black women who accompanied a large portion of the domestic labor force lacked an institutional mechanism to wrestle surplus value back from their bosses, i.e. like black women didn't really have unions that they could be a part of and have a voice in at that time, right? Her analysis of the super exploitation of black working class women, while Left of Karl Marx, represented an advancement of Marxism as a whole with relation to the role of capitalism played in compounding modes of exploitation on working women and the special oppression of black people. And Jones sort of, in tackling the black question, she fleshed out a material understanding of their conditions, of black women's conditions, and how they contributed to the advancement of Marxist theory, and included the nuances of the black question, right? So in her seminal piece, her most well-known piece, The End of to the Neglect of the Problem of the Negro Women, that in order to fight against imperialism and liberation of the working class as a whole, to be successful necessitates the overcoming of the neglect of special problems of black women. That the rise and very militancy of black women against imperialism and racism and sexism would rise the level of the overall movement against imperialism. So I had some more that I wanted to talk about. Sorry, there's a lot of history here. But I think I want to like go back in wrapping up. I want to go back to really wrapping up the fourth Comintern did and how they contributed to the advancement of colonialism and how they sided on the question of black liberation in favor of black folks, right, in struggle, and how they also influenced the American socialist and communist left. So the Congress established a commission that Hugheswood chaired and McKay sat on as guests and drafted a resolution on black struggle that was in many ways similar to the ABB program. And sort of a quick rundown of the recommendations that in the thesis. Support every black movement and undermines the weakness of capitalism or places barriers in its path. Full equality of the black and white races. Against the color bar in trade unions for union organization of black workers. And take immediate steps to convene a general congress of blacks in Moscow. Which the Soviets and Russia followed through on this and really pushed the communist left in the States to do the same thing. So I think it's important to highlight the importance of the Fourth Comintern in moving the American socialist left on the black question, which was a reflection of their own influence heavily by the contribution of West Indian revolutionaries. The Comintern understood that liberation of black people and the support of it was a reflection of how the contribution of struggle for black liberation made the uprising of subjugated people globally against colonialism and racism.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.